Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Aaron Newcomb joins me. We're going to talk about Arc OS. It's a great little all-in-one system for your Raspberry Pi and maybe other devices eventually soon, where you can host files, you can do all sorts of operations. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Aaron Newcomb, episode 278, recorded January 8th, 2014, Arc OS. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, Libre, open-source software. I'm your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at StoneAge.com, bringing you, as often as I can, mostly weekly, a few gaps here and there, especially for holidays, the movers, the shakers, the big projects, the small projects, the projects you may be using every day, the projects you might not have heard of ever, and as usual, I'm tongue-tied early this morning, but it's a great show. I'm happy to be back. It's the new year. We had to take a couple weeks off for the holidays. I'm back after nearly back-to-back. That's where I wanted the word nearly, somewhere in the middle of that. But I'm on the land for like 4 months, so this ought to be good. I kind of get my land legs back. And speaking of the new year, for those watching the video, this is a new background, and that's because I'm in my new gig. I just landed the deal where I'm going to be working for an indefinite amount of period for, I'll mention anyway, because I'm providing the space, ZipRecruiter, and you can go look that up and find out what it is. I won't bore you with it here. But I also got, if you're watching on the video, you might see also this is the Big Blue Yeti Pro that I have not had been able to use for a few months. And I also have my Fez, as you saw at the beginning of the show. So all the pieces are back in place. One other piece we're missing up until 5 seconds now, my co-host, Aaron Newcomb. Welcome back to the show.
I'm glad I can be that missing piece for you, Randall. Well, I know how those missing pieces drive you nuts, so I'm glad.
Oh, they do. They do, actually. It's when I don't have all the little things that I need. And because I am sort of ADD? No, not ADD. What is...
ADHD?
No, where is it when you have to have everything, like a complete LCD. Set and everything done in the right order?
OCD.
OCD, yes.
I say LCD because, you know, I live in a digital world.
Something else. Right. Okay. Well, now we're just rambling on. Back into the game here. Our project today is Arc OS, and it's apparently a sort of a self-hosting platform, so you can make your Raspberry Pi initially, but I think they're looking at other hardware platforms. I really glad you're here, Aaron, because I know almost nothing about the Raspberry Pi, and you know a lot about the Raspberry Pi. Can you describe Arc OS a little bit better?
Sure. Well, I don't know if I can describe it better than that, but I can tell you what I think it is based on playing around with it a little bit. It's basically, for me, what it does is it makes using something like a Raspberry Pi or a media server really, really simple and not very expensive at all, because you can use the Raspberry Pi, which is a $25 or $35 device. Actually, you're going to need the $35 device for this, I believe, right now, because you need that Ethernet port. So you can use a $35 device, and you can, all through web configuration, you can set up your home media server. You can set up your own Dropbox type of thing at home. You can do all kinds of things. You can host your own websites and all kinds of things, and it's all web driven, which is really cool. You just click a few buttons and say, yeah, I want to do this, this, and this. Boom, bada bing, bada boom, it's done. You don't have to worry about it. But don't take it from me. We're going to bring our guest in just a minute, and he'll explain to you probably a lot better than I just did.
Given that he started the project and he's sort of still the chief head honcho, I'm sure he will. That sounds like a great explanation, though. Well, without further ado, let's go ahead and bring Jacob Cook onto the show. Jacob, welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Well, there we are. Okay, we're all on the screen. Yes.
Yeah, nice.
Amazing.
Technology.
Amazing. Yes, how did that work? Anyway, where are you speaking to us from?
I'm in Montreal, Canada.
Cool. And so let's start with the 30,000-foot view. Aaron, take a stab at it. Probably did pretty well, from what I could hear. But what's the problem this thing is solving?
Well, I think today, I mean, this is open to interpretation, but in my opinion, we really live in sort of a golden age of open source server technologies. There are things like OwnCloud, which you did an interview with a few weeks ago, if I'm not mistaken, where you can host all manner of different data and you can access it very easily. However, the problem with a lot of these different suites is that it's not really made easy to get started with. You still have to have command line experience, know about how to secure your own server if you want to host any of these things yourself and not have to rely on an external company like Google or anyone else to do it for you. So the problem that ArcOS tries to solve is giving people the ability to easily install and configure these different software suites that are already available without, ideally, without having to touch the command line at all. And that will open this up to a much wider audience than just the traditional geeks like maybe the three of us here that would have been able to do it before.
You know, I'm seeing that in a lot of open source projects is that, you know, they all started out usually pretty geeky, and so the command line interface were there, and some other group comes along and puts a really nice web interface in front of it. I'm thinking in particular like a pfSense, and we had somebody on a couple of weeks ago that was like that too for Asterisk, I forget what it was called, but free, basically a web interface.
The free PBX.
Yeah, exactly, free PBX and stuff. What's the biggest challenge in, well, let's back up a little bit. How did this get started? What did you, and how long has it been in production so far?
Well, it's been in production since about February of 2013 of last year. And it got started basically after I had spent a couple of years hosting my own server, getting everything set up when it comes to email, to an XMPP chat server, and so on. And going through all that experience of learning going from 0 to 60 by my own and saying, wow, if it takes this long for me to do it, then it must take, you know, forever, if not impossible, for people who don't have the skills that I or someone like me would have. So that's what really initially prompted it.
Cool. And so if I were to want to start playing with this, I'd obviously need a Raspberry Pi. And Aaron made the distinction in the opening of the difference between a $25 thing and a $35 thing. I don't know what either of those things are, but is there, like, do you need the $35 thing, like he said?
Yes, you do. The $25 model has lower performance specifications, and I believe it doesn't even have an Ethernet port. So you wouldn't be able to host many services on that. So, yeah, you would definitely need the $35 model.
And I would set this up somewhere in my house attached to the internet, like maybe over Wi-Fi or over a hard line, and then install this software. And then what do I get at that point? Do I get like a web server and maybe some other services?
Well, what you do is you just have an installer program that you run, which is available for Linux or OS X at this point, and it installs to the SD card port that's in your computer. So you plug that into the Raspberry Pi, and then you branch that directly into your router at home. And from there you enter in a web address and you can see the administrative interface automatically on the browser on the laptop, you know, that's connected to the same network. And from there you can install different plugins. The management interface itself is actually a fork from a prior webmin like project called Agenti. And already from the base you can have website hosting, automatic creation of databases when necessary, and so on. You can just click, okay, I want to be able to install a WordPress site, and click that, and then you can add a WordPress site by just going through a wizard that asks you a few basic questions, and by the end of the process, you're automatically set up. So it's that kind of approach that it brings to websites right out of the box, and that it will also bring to other services like email and chat services in the future.
And so this is primarily intended, it seems like it would be mostly intended so that people from outside your house can get to this stuff. Doesn't that require a certain level of having a well-known address or using some sort of Dyn DNS protocol?
Well, that's one of the obstacles that the project is setting out to abridge as much as possible. Right now, since it's in the early stages, yes, you would need to have a dynamic DNS service and to make sure that your ISP is not blocking any ports and so on. In the future, the project will have its own easily integrated dynamic DNS service, which will work basically in the first run wizard. So you say, okay, set the name of the server, set the dynamic DNS name that you want to have, and then it's easy as that. It automatically does the registration for you and so on. So there are lots of different things that we plan on doing in order to make that process easier, whereas right now it's probably not very easy. Another way that you could get around things like that is we eventually hope to move on to cloud services. Now, it might sound kind of strange having a self-hosted cloud being hosted on the cloud. It gets kind of redundant after a while. But say you have a DigitalOcean droplet, like a virtual private server somewhere, you should be able to run an ArcOS server with the management interface and all of that on your DigitalOcean VPS or Linode VPS or whatever it is. And then you have connectivity and you don't even have to worry about it, but you still have the ease of use and the additional measure of security by running the things in your own little container.
Well, does that mean then that if I'm trying to visit your website hosted on your Raspberry Pi at your house, I'm going to be traversing other people's servers to get there, and does it introduce some additional security issues?
No, it's not. It doesn't really use a mesh topology, if I'm understanding the question correctly. If it's the dynamic DNS, then it does have to go through the central point just for the DNS to resolve, and then it knows how to get to your specific location. But yeah, whenever you're hosting things from home like that, there are a lot of difficulties because no person's ISP and situation is exactly the same. But a lot of the different tools that we have and that we're working on integrating into the project will be able to take on those use cases one by one and make it as secure and reliable as possible while still enabling people to keep control over their data.
Are you also looking at the long-range roadmap of maybe having some sort of NAT-piercing stuff so that I can still have a dynamic address, but somehow it comes through the inbound NAT properly?
That is something that we're looking at, yeah. I can't give too many details because it's still in the works and it's still in the R&D phase, so to speak. But we do have some solutions, including WebSockets and other things that we're going to be using in order to make that easier.
Cool, yeah, because connectivity, especially in this day and age where everybody gets like one IP address because the IPv4 is so restricted, it's really hard now to run home servers because they need the pieces of that. So I'm setting up a web server. If somehow I'm getting it online through maybe address mapping or port mapping, things like that, and then I put in content. Does the Raspberry Pi have like external hard drives? Like, can I have a lot of content there? Or only is there just the internal flash RAM, whatever it has? Like I said, I don't really know much about the Pi.
Well, the Raspberry Pi runs off of an SD card for its primary storage, and that's really not dependable, especially when you're hosting your own server and you want that data to be available 9 times out of 10 at the very least. So one thing that you can do is you can connect an external USB hard drive. And one of the things that we're working on as we speak, actually, is being able to use just the SD card as a bootable device and then have all of the data residing on an external hard drive. So that's maybe not an ideal solution for someone who already has an x86 computer, which has tons of storage and they don't need to worry about these problems. But if you have the Raspberry Pi and you still want to use it as a server, then it's definitely a way around some of its limitations to make it still pretty reliable. So one of the things that people are using even now with ArcOS is they have the Raspberry Pi and they have like a 1 terabyte external hard drive connected to the Raspberry Pi. And they can use software like OwnCloud. They can get it set up in 60 seconds with ArcOS. And then they run a few commands in order to switch the data partition over to their external hard drive, and then they have their own personal cloud that was easy to set up and wasn't a nightmare to get started with using. So things like that will also be a big part of making ArcOS a success in the future.
Whoop, there I am. I noticed one of the things is, like as you mentioned OwnCloud, for example, you can set that up really easily. But if I started really uploading files and things to OwnCloud, I mean, I would fill up that SD card pretty quickly. So it's nice that the Raspberry Pi does have USB ports and you can connect external storage. It's really key. I'm kind of curious about the name before we get more into the technology. Where did this whole Arc Noah theme come from? Because I noticed there's ArcOS and then there's Genesis. And I thought I saw one more too that was a reference to the biblical Noah here. So how did that all get started? Are you expecting a disaster soon? What are you not telling us here?
Well, I sort of came up with a name earlier this year when the NSA revelations were first coming out, and listening to the news, it's hard not to be attached to things like that. And it's something that affects me a great deal personally, the idea that we're living in an age where we share more and more of our data with the people we know and the people we love, but that data can be intercepted at any time. by people who don't have our best interests at heart, whether they're huge corporations or governments or so on. So the name ArcOS is sort of the idea of each individual person taking all of their data, their sites, their emails, and so on, and putting on a little boat and then shipping out into the middle of nowhere, being so much self-reliant. And so that's kind of where I got the idea. And then I just sort of ran with it a little bit when I started naming the different individual components. Yeah. I thought it was cute.
Yeah. I mean, theoretically, you could run, and the nice thing about the Pi is, I mean, you can run it off of 4 AA batteries, literally. I've done it before. So, I mean, the nice thing is it is very portable. And, you know, we mentioned earlier, you mentioned that you do need the Ethernet port to get it connected. But, you know, you really could do this with Wi-Fi as well, right? I mean, it just takes a little bit more programming and, you know, to enable the Wi-Fi by default. The difficulty there comes in if you have to enter a password, of course, on first boot, right? I'm assuming that's why the Wi-Fi, that's where it becomes a little bit more troublesome, correct?
Exactly. The way that it's configured right now is to be out of the box. You plug it in and you don't have to connect it to the TV, which is usually what you do when you want to set up your Raspberry Pi for the first time. And it does that because it has an automatic network profile Ethernet via DHCP that gets set up when it first starts. So if you want to do something like a static IP address before you even get to the administrative interface right away, then yeah, you need to connect it to the TV. And it's the same if you have a Wi-Fi dongle, like a little Wi-Fi USB key. Another thing that affects Wi-Fi is that, you know, that it's not the most reliable thing in the world. If there's wireless interference in your area that interrupts sometimes, then that might affect your reliability. So it's definitely possible to host a server via Wi-Fi this way, but it's not recommended just due to those reasons.
Yeah. Well, you may have those type of interference problems up in Montreal. Down here in the States, you know, we never have Wi-Fi issues, ever.
Oh, never.
Yeah, totally tongue-in-cheek there. So yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Now, one of the things I found out just today, because I actually have this running on my own, one of my Raspberry Pis. I brought it in, and we'll show it in a minute. But here in the studio, I don't have access to, number one, I'm running Windows, unfortunately, because I'm using my work laptop. And I don't have access to Bonjour services. In other words, you set this up so that I could theoretically just go to ArcOS port 8000 once this is set up. And if I have Bonjour services available, I could actually, which automatically maps those things, then I could go right to the web interface. But since I'm running Windows, I don't have that. So I had to get the IP address. So we actually did have to go into the command line to get the IP address this morning to get this working. And one of the things I found out is that you're running Arch on this, not Debian or Fedora or CentOS or one of the other, you know, popular distributions. So I'm kind of curious, why Arch? Why'd you pick that? Is that something just because that's what you're familiar with, or?
Well, if I can just briefly address what you said initially regarding using the terminal to get the IP address, the Windows version of the installer suite, so to speak, isn't quite ready yet, just due to developer bottlenecking and getting the right people with the right skills in the right place. However, on Linux and Mac OS X, there's a version of the installer that, like I said before, automatically copies the image to the SD device, but it also has a network browser feature. And so you click the scan button, and it shows you a list of all Raspberry Pis on your local network. And if there is one that it can detect that is running ArcOS, it will give you its host name. It will allow you to shut it down remotely if need be, but it will also give you that IP address that you need if for some reason the DNS service isn't quite working properly on your local network.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because I totally forgot. I'm hardcore, so I loaded the image manually, and I forgot about the installer, so thank you for bringing that up. I totally forgot about that.
Yeah, definitely. The installer is a very important part of the project because, I mean, like I said, if the entire focus is trying to get things set up easily with as little terminal use as possible for end users, then installation is also a big part of the experience too. To address your question regarding using an Arch-based system rather than any of the others, there are a few different reasons for that. Partially because, yes, I am an Arch fanboy, and I will admit it. But it's mostly because I think that the way that many of its services work, like Pac-Man and Network Control, those are things that network control, for example, is very easy to use, very easy to get set up. You don't have to worry with any of the other things that you might have to run through GNOME or to get your network set up. It just connects to networks, and that's great. And that's something that I wanted to have happen out of the box. So it's little things like that, plus the fact that Arch typically runs software packages direct from the source with as little external modification as possible. It makes it really easy to modify. If you want to make any modifications, you don't have to worry about dpackage and all of these other stuff that Debian might do. So while I certainly do like Debian and I use it for some of my servers on my VPSs, I just wanted a lot of flexibility in getting ArcOS set up, and that's why I chose Arch.
Right. Awesome. So this reminds me a lot of something like Webmin, although not entirely, because even with Webmin, you've got to go in and get something set up first on your Linux box. But it reminds me a little bit of Webmin in the way that you actually just go in and you can administer things very easily, and you can just kind of pick what you want to install from the command from the web interface, which I think is great. How difficult was that to get set up, all those things? And we should say, too, this isn't a final project, right? I mean, talk about the status of where the project is at, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, absolutely. It's far from being done, far from being ready for even general use. We just had a funding campaign back in November, which was successful. We raised $53,000 of our $45,000 target, and that will enable me basically to work full-time on the project for the next year, as well as paying for certain things such as upkeep for the repository servers and so on. And by July, there will be a stable version of the software release that will be bug-free enough for people that, you know, don't really have the time to spend with maybe taking one or two extra trips to the terminal when they have to be able to use it reliably. So that's the state of the project as it is right now.
And then how difficult was it to get the, or how difficult is it, since this is still a work in progress, to actually get things running out of the web interface? You said you based this on an existing project already?
Yeah, it was based on, it was fork from a prior version of a Webmin-like server software called Agenti, similar to Webmin, but it looks quite a bit more flashier than Webmin does, at least the last time I used Webmin. But it's been modified in several important ways, and it's only going to continue to grow and change more as the software develops. One thing that you might notice about software suites like Webmin is that they do present a visual interface to managing a server, but it doesn't make it a lot easier in the sense that if you're still not a systems administrator, then you probably still won't know what you're doing if you're looking at Webmin. So one of the goals is to not just make a visual manager for your server, but make it something that's easy. Provide wizards with language that maybe not 99% of the people will be able to understand, but people who don't, you know, have their A+ certification, for example, will still be able to go in and set up their own website and be able to run things without too much hassle or effort. And so I think that was sort of a niche that I saw in the graphical server administration market, so to speak, that hasn't really been filled yet. And that's something that I've really wanted to put a lot of time in for this project.
Yeah, and especially for the Raspberry Pi. I mean, so much of what you do on the Raspberry Pi is command line. And even though there's a GUI available to you, you can run X. If you want to set something up, it's mostly manual at this point. And that's what I love about this project is, you know, you've made a way for people to just load something, and you made it easy for them to load something on the SD card that when it comes up, they don't have to really go to the command line. They don't have to know about it. They don't have to know what the IP address even is in most cases. So, you know, I think that's really great. In fact, we can show what the interface looks like. I've got it up running here. So this is what you get, I believe, and you can walk us through this if you want, Jacob. This is what you get when this comes up, and I'm going to go ahead and put in, I think the password and username are both admin, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, so we'll put those in there and log in and see what happens. The other thing that amazed me about this is it's really quick on the Raspberry Pi. I mean, there's a lot of things out there that do run on the Raspberry Pi, but they don't run very quickly.
Yeah.
If you ever tried to compile code natively on the Raspberry Pi, you'll know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, for sure.
So here we are. So this is the main screen, right?
Yeah, that's the screen that shows up when you first start it up for the first time, and it will guide you through a few steps to get it set up. It's called the first run wizard.
Okay, so we'll go ahead and click OK and see what comes up. So it's asking us for a new username. Mm-hmm. And I'll just put in user. Oops, I got to click it. There we go.
Yeah.
And then an admin password. We'll just leave that admin so we don't get confused. There we go. You can see this is actually, I mean, if you're used to running things on the Raspberry Pi, you can see this is actually happening quite quickly. Mm-hmm. Then what's this screen for? The initial system settings, huh?
Yeah. So this will just set things like your time zone, your host name, and so on. Down there in the third option, you'll see a checkbox that said expand ArcOS to fit SD card. You know, if you write the image directly to your SD card when you're installing, whether this is for Raspbian or any other OS on the Raspberry Pi, it doesn't get expanded automatically to fill the entire SD card. So if you check that, it will expand it, and then it will just tell you to reboot the system afterwards, and then it will automatically fill up the entire SD card.
Okay. I'm not going to do that now since we're doing a little demo. Yeah. It does take a few minutes. Not long, actually. It doesn't take very long. But so then we're going to optimize the graphical memory and allow SSH as root, which is always nice since we're not too concerned about security right now here at the brick house. I think we're okay. All right. Now we've got a whole list of stuff we can choose to install here.
Yeah, so these are the different sort of plugins that you can install, and each of these will allow a different functionality for Genesis itself. And that's the cool thing about Agenti that I really liked, and one of the reasons why I decided to fork that specific project to expand upon it is because it is a plugin-based interface. You just create a Python script, 100 or 200 lines of Python, and you can have a management system and a full interface for managing whatever piece of software it is, and you can integrate it into Genesis automatically. So each of those things in that list there will give you, like, it will add a different type of database that you can install. It will allow you to install WordPress or OwnCloud and set it up as a website that way, and so on.
Cool. So what are a few? Let's just go ahead and do it. What are a few simple things we can install here? Notepad should be an easy one, right?
Yeah.
And maybe what else? File manager. We can look at our files that way.
Some of these plugins haven't been met or modified or overhauled quite a bit since they were introduced from Agenti, and those are a couple.
Yeah, I noticed
a couple
terminal,
examples of that. But.
At least in my, I tried this once earlier at home, and I know Terminal wasn't working for me, but I don't know, I'm not sure exactly why. So we've got, what else would you suggest? We've got file manager and Notepad. What are a couple? Any other quick ones we can do? It won't be too hard.
Task
monitor,
good.
Maybe?
Yeah, sure. That will just show you. Yeah,
it'll give us something visual, right?
So, system. Yeah, okay, yeah, for sure.
So I've got those three things, and then we'll just go ahead and click download and install.
Okay.
And then we can talk for a few minutes. I think it takes what, probably like 60 seconds, a minute, a couple minutes, usually, depending on how much you install, probably, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So let's do that.
And whenever you install a package, it automatically has to install all of its dependencies, too. So if you choose to install MySQL, then it will have to install MySQL in the background. And
right. So this is done. Actually, yeah. I said it was going to take longer. It actually only took about 15 seconds.
Yeah.
So it's got
If you choose WordPress and if you choose MySQL, then, yeah, it'll take a bit longer. But
right.
Yeah, it's pretty quick to get set up. That's one of the things that I like about running Python on the Raspberry Pi is that it's pretty snappy compared to other languages like PHP, which can be kind of slow at times.
Yeah, Python does seem to be the preferred language for a Raspberry Pi at this point. So I noticed right down here under Tools, we've already got File Manager ready to go and Notepad. So let's click on File Manager and see if this thing, see if it actually works. I love live demos. They never work, but I love doing live demos. So here we go. We can see our root. I think this is root, right? Yeah, root file system. I'm assuming that's what the slash means here, root file system. And you can see if you're used to Linux, the way they do their file system layout, you can tell, you know, we've got dev and we've got etsy and home. And if we go into home, we should see our user directory that we created. So here's my user called user. There's no files in there, but that's kind of cool. So we can go there. Mm-hmm. And then let's see. I can click on the slash here to go back, and we can browse around. Yeah, this is pretty cool. I can go into Etsy and see all my files there. Now, this isn't going to show. What is this? What actually permissions is this using to show me this? Is this my the user that I created, the inherited position permissions that the user has?
Oh, it's presently running as root on the device itself. Ah, okay. So when you use something like the file manager or the terminal or shell execution, those are happening as root, which isn't fantastic if you have someone who doesn't know what they're doing. But the goal is to add a different model of execution for things like that, primarily for individual users to have a little bit more safety, but also to put all of those things in an area that's, you know, a bit more out of reach than right in front of people.
Yeah, yeah, because I'm not seeing like hidden files and things like that here.
Okay.
Right, so at least that's good. I mean, you can't, well, I guess you could screw things up, but hopefully...
Yeah, the version of the file manager that we're working on now is you're going to be able to upload and download files through the web interface, so you don't have to use SCP or FTP or something like that. You'll be able to upload and download backups. It automatically backups your configuration. It'll automatically backup your data. You'll be able to transfer it through the file manager. And those are all things that I have that I'm tinkering with right now, but that aren't quite ready to be pushed into master yet.
Yeah. So I'm loading up the task monitor now, and you can see, you know, this looks like it gives me the. I don't know how do you update this if you need to update.
That's just if like you enter top in the terminal, it will show you all a list of the commands and.
Okay, but it's not dynamic. If I wanted to update it, I'd probably have to refresh the page or something.
Not at this time. I have a dynamics version working, but like right. I said, it's not pushed.
You can see this is a very busy system right now. System D is using 1% of the RAM and 0% CPUs. There's not a whole lot going on this. Let's try Notepad, see if that's any more interesting. This is really cool because, you know, you can get in here and do things right away. I mean, you don't have to wait for packages to load. You don't have to install a special go to the command line and compile something. I mean, it's actually happening right in the web browser, and I didn't have to do any command line at all. This is really good, especially since the Pi is for makers, right? I mean, I say it's for makers because I'm a maker, but I mean, it's really to enable people to use the technology quickly and easily, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when you're doing things like hosting websites or network connected services, that's where ArcOS really shines and will continue to be improved in the future, because like you said, for people who are makers, for people who are into the do it yourself, which I am, I acknowledge, it's great. It's very important to be able to do something and not have to spend your entire weekend just get WordPress set up and working properly.
Right.
You know?
Right. What kind of response have you gotten from this so far? I know that there's some stuff on the website, some links to some people that have been picking up on this, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, the funding campaign back in November was a huge boost. We got reports from VentureBeat, from Der Spiegel in Germany, from Heise. There was a piece in the New Yorker that mentioned the project a few weeks ago. So the response has been great. It's been overwhelming, basically, since the beginning of November when all of it really started to kick off. But all of that support is going to be channeled into making the next 6 months for the project as productive as possible and turning it into something that can really stand alone as an alternative for people to services like Google or large hosting company.
Yeah. Now, did you do a Kickstarter or anything like that to try to raise some funds?
Yeah. Well, the funding campaign was a Kickstarter kind of model. It was a crowdfunding campaign. I had actually created the website by hand with the sources up on GitHub just because I wanted to be able to accept Bitcoin. And it's the DIY thing, like I mentioned before. Yeah. I made the website myself, but yes, it was a crowdfunding campaign.
But you made your own Kickstarter basically to
funding. Yeah, I made it out of it was a Django based website.
That's hilarious. So we know this is in the beginning stages. how long do you think it's going to take before, because like we said, some of these services, some of them aren't really working, or at least they weren't working for me. Some of them are still a little non-intuitive, like if you want to set up OwnCloud, for example. It does prompt you, by the way, but you have to go set up MariaDB as well first, and mm-hmm. then you have to go in and start the service. And it does prompt you and say, hey, look, MariaDB is not running. You can't go to the OwnCloud website yet. I had some issues there getting that going, but I guess what's the next phase for this? When is it going to be not production ready, but at least it seems like right now it's still somewhere between alpha and beta. So when are we going to actually have an official release?
The first official stable release for general use is going to be coming in May or June, I believe, is the target I have on the website. Right now, yeah, it's definitely in early adopter territory, but there's another release coming in January, which will resolve a lot of the problems that some people have been having getting things set up with websites and databases, as well as SSL certificates. And there's another release in the middle that will add even more features and hopefully more stability, going through and changing some of the frameworks that were initially ported in from Agenti and making them a bit more robust and stable. And then also spreading to more platforms than just the Raspberry Pi, which is something that's hugely important for people. If you have another ARM-based system like a BeagleBoard or a Kubi board or something like that, and you want to be able to run ArcOS, then you'll be able to do so within the next couple of months. So now that the funding campaign has been successful, then it's definitely go time, and things will start happening very quickly over the course of the next few months.
You're making a very bold statement. You're actually giving a schedule to an open source project. Do you realize how risky that is?
I know. Well, I mean, I gave schedules over the course of the last year too, and I think that I was accurate about maybe 90% of the time. So I think that's pretty good, maybe.
Are you looking for a job in the real world as a programmer? Because I think that's an asset that nobody else has.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Well, now that the campaign's been successful, this is my job, at least for the next 12 months. So I'm going to be working on it as much as possible.
Oh, so you're actually funding yourself out of this, or this isn't just a night and weekend project for you?
No. Well, that's what it was over the past year, but I realized that I needed to be able to make a bigger commitment to it if it's going to be successful in a time frame anywhere resembling what it should be. When I first started the project, I was a student going to university, and then I had my side job full-time, and then I had this, and then I have my personal life. So anyone involved with open source software knows that making that balance is not very easy at all. So I'm very, very happy and fortunate that I was able to do the funding campaign, which allows me to do what I love and maybe help people further their own self-hosting desires, I guess.
And so after you've spent all the money from the Kickstarter on Cheetos and Mountain Dew and finished up your year, is it going to keep being a labor of love? Are you envisioning some sort of company around this, like to provide support or customized versions or something? What's the long-range plan for this?
Well, the software itself is, it's definitely open source, and it will always be free to use, free to download, free to install. Mm-hmm. Towards the beginning of the interview, we mentioned a few things like getting people connected if they have poor network connections, if they don't have static IP address from their ISP, if they don't know what any of this means, if they want a little bit of a leg up that you can't do just by purely self-hosting all of your data from home. There are services that I plan to offer to help people with that. And I'm hoping that with those services, priced nominally, those will be able to sustain the project in the long run. I haven't excluded the possibility that those won't work. So if for some reason that model doesn't pan out, then it will definitely continue to be a labor of love for me, because I do want to continue no matter if it's financially sustainable or not.
Awesome. So you're the paid guy working on this, but do you have other volunteers that are also assisting you? And what areas are they doing? And what's the governance look like for that? How do you decide what to hand out, or just whoever wants to come in and help out, or what? How do you manage this project?
Well, it's very, very early on, like I've been saying, and mm-hmm. both in terms of software development and in terms of project management. I'm the one who does most of the development on the Linux side of things and on for the management interface Genesis, as well as the installer. I have people, you know, working on the Windows version of the installer, other individuals who are working on the dynamic DNS system and port proxy. That's going to be a big thing going forward. And they're from all over the world. And then there's people working on the documentation, people helping with support requests and so on. So in the future, I'd like to maybe put a bit more of a bit more management, a bit more structure into how that all works. It's definitely a volunteer basis, and we do have different volunteers from all over who are contributing to different parts of the project.
Wow. So given that kind of spread, you must have some really public tools. Like, are you using GitHub and GitHub's bug tracker and things like that?
Yeah. Using GitHub for code hosting, using the bug tracker on GitHub for managing tickets. There's a translation system called Poodle that I've been playing with for a while, and that's how we're getting translations for the installer. And soon it will also be getting translations for the for all the other pieces of the software. There's MediaWiki, which is what I've just moved the documentation to, which is what a lot of people are using to update the documentation.
The big problem with the wiki is its big advantage is that it's self-organizing. Its big disadvantage is that it's self-organizing instead of actually having somebody put some thought into it. And of course, you always have the spam problem and people putting random things in random places. Is there going to be other documentation, like maybe like a how-to guide, get started? There's a little bit of that already I saw on the website, but is there going to be somebody more, like me, the more experienced at writing tutorials, going to step in? Or is that what you're hoping that somebody will do?
Well, that's we're not quite at that stage yet, but that's what the wiki is for, is for basically people who have been able to get it work on a device that's not officially supported by the project yet. They can say, okay, here's your tutorial on how to get it on X device. So that's one of the big reasons why I moved the documentation from WordPress, which is what the main site's hosted on, to the wiki. But there will always be sort of officially sanctioned documents that are available on the WordPress site that say, here's the step-by-step process to get started, and using all of the officially tested and approved devices and so on, just to make sure that the experience is as painless as possible for people.
Cool. And you mentioned a bunch of roles of kinds of people that you want. What would I have to know in order to help out? Obviously, I'll have to know about the specific thing I'm contributing to, but like, is there a ramp-up curve of people that can contribute to this?
Well, most of the development now is done in Python, which that's the major language for the management interface. If you know Python and you want to help out, let me know. If you know JavaScript and you want to help out, let me know, because that's also a big part of the management interface. Also, if you have any sort of Linux experience, we're looking for help with hosting the repositories for the new hardware platforms that we're going to be branching out to. So also get in contact with that if you have a pet hardware platform that you like, and maybe you'd like to help host the repository for it, and maybe do cross-compilation and things like that. Even to just down to, if you just like the idea of self-hosting, there are lots of people who are getting more and more into their decentralization spirit. You can help with spreading the word about the project and adding to the documentation and so on. So one of the things that I've said for months now is that no offer of help will be refused. There's always something that someone can do, regardless of their skill level, to help push this along if someone believes in it.
And actually, earlier you had a comment about, I think it was Aaron had a comment about how actually compiling on the Pi would be really slow. Is this all done in a Linux cross-compiling environment or something?
Well, since it's just on the Raspberry Pi, we're getting packages upstream, most of the packages upstream from Arch Linux ARM. Mm-hmm. In the future, that's going to change, though, once we go out to additional platforms. So yes, those will be cross-compiled. And then there are individual programs that I have to compile even now just for the Raspberry Pi that, yes, those are cross-compiled on my home server.
And I presume this is all under some sort of GPL license?
Yeah, all of the software that we have released to date is GPL, and it will always be. Even the suites that we would have to charge for nominally just to keep them running to cover the costs, those will also be open source and probably AGPL or something as close to that as possible, because I really do like that license.
And so that license was chosen deliberately and not just inherited from the thing you sort of forked from?
Well, it's GPL v3. Genesis was GPL v2, I believe, or Agenti was GPL v2 at the time that it was forked. So that was something, you know, we relicensed it up to the new version, and that was something that we did do. But it's also a license that, you know, in the off time, whenever I write software, is something that I try to do. So I did choose it deliberately for all of the other tools involved in the project.
Very cool. Where's my questions? I got lost in my questions.
Well, let's go to some questions from the chat room then, since you're looking.
There we go. Yeah. Aaron, you want to take those?
Then when you find your questions, we'll get back.
Yes, sorry.
Because there was a question that I thought was very interesting, just came up in the chat room, is someone was asking about JavaScript security risks. This was at a kind of an anonymous chat room. Web9903 was asking about JavaScript security risks and how you go about avoiding them for this particular type of project.
Well, most things regarding JavaScript and security, except for the security plugins that they're already developing, are still basically unchanged from the fork with Agenti, and there hasn't been a whole lot done with that yet. That being said, you do have to worry about the same things like cross-site scripting and stuff like that whenever you have a web interface for managing your software. So we're actually working right now on a system for better validation in JavaScript that should be able to eliminate most of those problems and at least bring it in with the reasonable expectation of people whenever they're using a web-based management system.
Yeah. And then I also saw, I don't know if you saw the news about Intel's Edison chip that they just announced at CES. I know you said that you were developing this for BeagleBoard, but I'm wondering maybe this might run on something like Edison. Then you could really be, because Edison is just the size of an SD card itself. What do you think about something like the Edison, or that you think that might not be powerful enough? It does have a dual core CPU in it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I haven't followed CES that closely this year as opposed to most years. However, if it can run Linux, then I would like it to be able to run ArcOS in the future. The only real prerequisites that a platform will have is can it run Linux? Can it run Python? And is there the manpower there to be able to extend the platform to support or to extend the software to support that platform, excuse me. Mm-hmm. So yeah, those are really the only prerequisites that I have. If there's demand for it, then I'll definitely spend the time that I have available to make it work.
Well, Jacob, we're just about out of time, so I want to make sure I always have a couple standard questions at the end of the show. If you've watched the show before, you know what they're about to be. But there's also one other very important question I want to ask is there anything in the time that we've been together that we didn't talk about that you want to make sure our audience is aware of?
Not that I can think of, really. I mean, one common question that I get asked a lot is, how does this relate to another project in this sphere, kind of like FreedomBox? And, I know I could take a long time to talk about this, but I won't. But one of the differences is in just in the way the project is organized. We want to do one thing first, and that is to give people the ability to easily manage their own server software. And if there's something that we want to do in the future when it comes to networking or mesh networking or redundancy and stuff like that, that's going to be secondary to the initial goal. So I think that being able to start with something and achieve something first before we move on to a much bigger idea is probably one of the things that separates us from the other project and makes it so that we are maybe having a bit more success, maybe a bit more progress, maybe a bit more quickly.
Very good, very good. Okay, I got to ask the two required questions or I get yelled at an email. Seriously, when I don't do these questions, people yell at me because we want to know what to put on the scoreboard. So, favorite text editor? I'm not going to let you answer.
I say Nano, will you laugh at me?
No, Nano sort of looks like Emacs, so I like it. It's kind of like a tiny Emacs. I'm fine with that.
Yeah, I grew up using Joe, but I switched to Nano, and I play no part in that whole Emacs versus NB.
Nice, nice. And I know I'm not going to like the answer to this next one, which is favorite scripting language. Yes?
Python.
Python. Oh, sorry. It glitched just then. Sorry. Okay. Yeah, of course it's Python, right.
It's got to be you Python kids, on the pie.
You kids and your Python on Ruby and all that stuff. We didn't have that when we were young. Come on. We need real stuff like Perl and Basic and crap. Yeah, that's sorry.
I can do Basic and I can do Shell, but, you know, Python still remains the number one for a lot of reasons.
You probably think Bash is the real Shell, though. It's not.
I'm kind of part of a younger generation that would consider that to be the case. I use Zed Shell, though. So.
Oh, you use Z Shell, right? You say Zed in Canada, I know. But yeah, Z Shell is awesome. In fact, I've often wondered if Perl would exist if Z Shell had existed 15 years ago, 20 years ago, because it seems to have a lot of overlap in terms of being cool. I don't think it scales as well, though. I think Perl definitely scales a lot better.
It just fixes a lot of those little teeny tiny annoying problems that I have with Bash, and so that I can go, my terminal is my home now.
except that the documentation is like 400 pages if you really read it all. It's not just the man pages. I mean, it's so big it has like 17 man pages, and that doesn't even count the sort of the info doc that you can get with it as well. And I still don't understand all of it, but at least I know how to do a ZSHRC that runs when I SSH in remotely without a terminal. It's so hard to get the other languages to do that, or the other shells to do that. So really crazy. Awesome. Yep. Awesome. So great. Look, it's been really great having you on. I know a lot of people now are going to go look at your website about ArcOS. They're into that sort of small hosting thing, or especially the people that have Pi so they can play with it. And you've been a great guest. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
Great. So that's Jacob Cook, who is the head honcho, the man at the helm, man at the chair. That doesn't make any sense. It's a man sitting in a chair at the helm of the ArcOS project. Aaron, what'd you think?
Well, you know me with these kinds of things. Open hardware, open software coming together. This is like, you know, nirvana for me, this kind of stuff. And it's really needed in the Raspberry Pi space because, like I said, Raspberry Pi, up until now, if you go look at any of the how-tos, how do I do this, what's the tutorial to get this running, it's, drop to the command line or, you know, plug in your cable to connect to your monitor and a USB keyboard and go do this, you know. And really, this avoids all that kind of stuff. And for somebody that just wants a very inexpensive server, like I said at the top of the show, to go do OwnCloud or to go do, you know, any number of very simple types of servers that you want to set up in your own, either your home environment or, like you say, access from the public internet, this is perfect. And it's really what the Raspberry Pi space has been lacking up till now, is these simple little, you know, plug-in designs, right? Like, okay, I've got my Raspberry Pi. I want to use it to make a robot. You know, this isn't quite in that category, but, you know, that's what the Raspberry Pi really needs at this point, is some of those simple things to say, like, okay, here's a robot puzzle piece. So you just add that to your mix, right? Or maybe it's a recipe. So it's like you're adding scallions to a recipe or something. So here's my robot piece I'm going to throw in here. Here's my web interface thing I'm going to throw in here. And maybe here's like an Android controller thing that I can use, a generic Android interface thing. You know, and you just put it all in there, and it all works, and you don't have to drop to the command line. So I think Jacob is right on in his view that this is really needed in this space at this time. So he's like at the right place, at the right time, at the right age to really take advantage of this. I think it's going to go far.
You mean us oldies aren't going to be able to do stuff like this?
No, I'm not able to type. I got arthritis, you know. too much Perl. Yeah. I can't move my fingers.
But, you know, from Emacs hitting the control key and Perl hitting the shift key, I'm pretty much ruined my left hand. So it's pretty crazy that way. You know, the thing I like about this is just seeing, you know, I am old enough to remember when computers cost $500,000. Or more, you know, $5 million for some of the big installations. And it's interesting to see the various ways computers could be applied as we dropped one order of magnitude down now six times. You know, $500,000 computers were basically large organization. They had central control, you know, and they had terminal things or whatever to hook up to it. You know, at $50,000, a department within an organization could buy one. And at $5,000, people could have it not around everybody's desk, but at least like a small thing that services three or four people. And then when it got down to the $500 region, you know, small laptops, netbooks, things like that, so many more opportunities. But now we're in the $50 region. And you can think about just buying four or five of these and setting them around your house doing different things, and or putting it inside some device that's controlled remotely and stuff. And it's just really empowering to see how this, you know, various stepping downs of price is really affected that. Have you seen that too?
Yeah, absolutely. You're seeing this more and more. And that's why you're seeing some of these efforts from companies like Intel to get into this space. I mean, they really want it, not only with mobile, right? I mean, that's their big drive right now, is to get into the mobile space, because they're afraid they're going to lose out on that. But also into the makerspace. They want to drive some of these projects that people have, you know, either doing embedded or doing, you know, running Linux on a small scale. I mean, some of the things that they were able to show off with Edison, like these baby monitors, you know, that are baked into the clothes that the babies are wearing. I mean, that's incredible. And this is, you know, you're not going to run, you know, well, I guess you could. You could run your own cloud on your baby. You would always know where it was. Maybe not. Maybe that's a little far-fetched. But, yeah, absolutely. This is where the future of technology is going. And this is a project. A lot of projects require you, for Raspberry Pi, to buy a USB-powered hub, to buy an adapter. And so when you start adding those costs on, you're still sub $100. But it adds on to the cost of the overall project. With this, really all you need is the Raspberry Pi Model B, the $35 version, and an SD card. So it's really amazing what you can do with technology. I continue to be impressed. You know, I still look at some of the things that we do in enterprise platforms, some of the things that we're running for customers and how expensive they are and stuff. And I think, man, this is all going to change in a few years once what we're doing now at the hobbyist level makes it up into the enterprise level. It's going to be really interesting.
And to bring it back to relevance for this show, well, everything you said is relevant anyway. The whole notion how free and open source software has really enabled all this. If we were still in an environment where when you bought your $50,000 mini computer, all you could run on it was the hardware vendor's proprietary operating system, you wouldn't have the kinds of things that we're seeing out of, you know, first the adoption or the creation of Unix, and that sort of, well, it wasn't really open source, it was licensed source to universities for free. But that gave a whole generation of people coming up through that particular era the idea that you could cooperate on software. And then, of course, you know, I sometimes diss Richard Stallman on this show, and I shouldn't do that very much because now I just offended all the card-carrying FSS holders. But I do occasionally, you know, the GPL has a purpose, and I don't always agree with its purpose, but one of the things it has done is sort of got that into people's minds that you take something that's open source, free software, so I'll say it because I'm talking about the GPL. They take something that's free software and you add to it and you can't hoard your additions. Mm-hmm. And I think that drove a lot of what happened in the early open source world. But I also like that we have permissive licenses like BSD and Apache and things like that, so that if what you really want to do is get maximum distribution and use of your software, you can say, here, just take it. I don't care what you do with it. I don't care if you add stuff to it and then resell that. I don't care. I just want to give you this base that I found to be useful for me. And that's, you know, definitely there are projects for which that's much more appropriate, and definitely there are projects that the GPL is just fine. And I'm glad we have that kind of choice. I'm glad these licenses are all carefully scrutinized by lawyers that make way more much money than I do. So very handy that that's all happened. Any last words, Aaron?
Well, no, I couldn't agree with you more. And also, if you think about another component to this, which Jacob brought up earlier, was the whole NSA stuff, right? And if you were restricted to non-free or closed-source software, in an effort to try to maybe, you know, start something that was, you know, I don't want to say off the grid. I mean, it's not like that. But I mean, if you want to do something that is a little bit more protective of your privacy, it's a whole lot easier to do that when you have open source software sitting in front of you, and you can build on top of that and adjust things the way that you want it to be. If we were all dependent on closed source things, then we would have to be dependent on companies that may be regulated by the government to put some things in there, like, yeah, you have to give us your encryption keys, for example, when you ship software overseas. So now, especially with all the concerns about privacy, I think that it's all the more important to have open source alternatives available to us in case something does happen and we do want to take matters into our own hands.
Although I heard some reports that the RSA algorithm has been deliberately compromised, so even having open source doesn't exactly help you. But
yeah, but it's a whole lot easier than if we had to work around closed source programming.
Yes, at least we can look at the mystical numbers that the NSA generated for us and go, why didn't we use the numbers that we started with?
Right.
Watch those diff logs, man. See who commits those patches. Little scary. All right. So speaking of scary, let's talk about the upcoming guest. That's my awkward transition for the week. You know I do that every time. We just added this show for next week. Scale 12X is coming up. You know from the many times that I've had Gareth Greenaway as a co-host here, that he's been running the show. He's going to come on next week to talk about Scale 12X specifically. He's also going to bring on a couple of co-hosts. Or no, well, I don't know if we're going to set that up as him as a co-host or him as a guest. I think I'm going to make him a co-host.
Yeah, make him a co-host.
And we can both ask questions of the other two guys or whoever he's bringing on. So I think by then he'll finally know the dates. Scale 12X. You have one job. All you need to do is know the dates. But we're going to talk about the speaker schedule and the keynote schedule and the extra dev days schedules. It's all set up now. We can actually go through the whole schedule and kind of talk about what's interesting about that. And if you're a producer of an event in some other city, you might specifically listen to that show because we're also going to talk about behind the scenes. How does this thing actually come together? How is the sausage made? So that'll bet you be a great show. Following that, we have Libre API, Roberto Rosario, who is in Puerto Rico. We had him on, I think, a couple years ago, and we were talking about sort of some software that he was creating to do government publication of documents. Well, they now have an API, so you can query things directly from their servers, things like what's the rainfall in the average rainfall in a city in Puerto Rico. Yeah, I hope that's one. Just making this up. But typical like government data is going to be opened up via APIs. They're also working on this in Portland, Oregon, too, which I'm really proud of. But anyway, he's going to come talk about that. We just added to the schedule also Genevieve. I don't know how that's pronounced, but we're going to have some people come on. And Genevieve is automotive open source software. So, you know, you have these in-dash components that are now getting smarter and smarter. Well, how about putting open source software in there, providing a stable platform for all the automobile manufacturers to use? Or maybe there'll be a way for you to just upload it directly to your particular machine, and then you can tweak it all you want. Imagine like the equivalent of a Raspberry Pi server, whatever, inside your car. Ooh, that could be distracting. Okay. Go is being discussed a little bit further, not the board game. Go is a language from Google. It allows for great concurrency. I think it's been out for like 3 or 4 years, or people that really are happy with it and really enjoying it. So we finally got the chief creator of that coming on. And then finally, of the last scheduled shows we have Core OS, which is Linux for massive server deployment. Should be pretty fun. I still am continuing to fill in Q1. I've got about 5 more dates left in Q1 to fill in. More emails going out this week, which I say every week and only do that every third week. So that's why it takes a long time to fill the shows. If you want to know how that's going, go to twitch.tv/floss. That's our homepage for the show. And from there, you see a spreadsheet linked, which talks about all the upcoming guests, the upcoming schedule. If you know somebody that should be on that schedule and isn't, please email the project leader for that project. And have email me at merlin@stonehenge.com. That's the fastest way to get him to the top of the list. You can follow us on Floss Weekly at Google+. I announce guests as they get added. I also announce the show 24 hours and 1 hour in advance, usually, if I remember to do that. Also, Floss Weekly on Twitter. We do have a live chat room. We're normally at 8:30 a.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays. We took many questions from the chat room this time. It was a pretty exciting topic, so a lot of people wanted to chime in and get their questions answered. So, again, I appreciate the chat room that's out there. You can also follow me. I'm at Merlin, M-E-R-L-Y-N, on Twitter. But more often, that's just an echo of what I'm actually saying. Most of my conversations are on Google+. That's at Randall L. Schwartz. So if you look for that, you'll find me. In fact, I think you just type google.com/plus Randall L. Schwartz. Which is weird because then it's finally the 2L version of my first name, which I hate. But just the middle initial is L. That's why it's over there. I'm trying to schedule an interview with where I'm being interviewed for the new Linux Voice podcast. Ben Everhart contacted me about being on that show. I think probably I'll be able to get to it maybe next week or the week after. I'm also going to be at SoCal Linux Expo, Scale 12X. I have been accepted both as press, so I'll be covering the show from a Floss Weekly perspective and hunting down future guests. But I'm also going to be speaking. If you heard me refer to my Half-Life with Perl talk that I gave at OSCON last year and also at the LA Perlmongers meeting, I'm going to be giving that again at Scale. So I've been accepted to talk about that. That's enough plugs for now. Aaron, what do you want to plug today?
So all kinds of things. I don't know if I'll be down at Scale or not. I'm still thinking about it. It's an awfully fun conference, and it's fun just to go for the gaming night, which happens after the first full night of the show. They have a gaming night, and they have, you know, beer, and they have the board games galore all over the place, and video games and stuff. It's really fun. They've done it now for quite a while. So I'd encourage you, if you're in the area or if you just want to go to a great Linux conference, go to Scale. It's great. Where can you find me? You can find me on Google Plus, just like you, Randall. I am Aaron Newcomb on Google Plus. You can also follow me on Twitter or Facebook if you prefer. I just don't get a chance to interact with people on those networks. On Google Plus, I do interact, and I have a lot of great conversations with people, and you'll see all kinds of stuff that I follow and talk about. Right now, it's kind of interesting. I'm uploading all of my pictures to Google Plus, not just the ones from my phone, but the ones from my home PC as well. And it's fun watching what Auto Awesome does to all of those pictures, because sometimes it's hit or miss. I mean, sometimes the algorithm gets it, sometimes it doesn't. But I had a really cool one the other day where it was a firework that I took a picture of a firework, and it just happened to be a round firework with things coming out, and then it did it lit up the firework. So it was doing this, it was going around. It was really cool. You should take a look at it. But yeah. I also talk about open source, Android, all things Google. I'm talking about all kinds of stuff. Of course, hacking and making stuff. So definitely follow me on Google Plus. You can also watch a lot of the other shows that I occasionally co-host here on the Twit Network, like All About Android, This Week in Google, TNT. I don't know. I've been on TNT before. We'll have to talk to Mike. Is Mike here? There's Mike over there. So we'll have to ask Mike, see if he'll have me on as a guest for TNT sometime. So definitely follow the Twit Network. That's where I do all of my podcasting these days as well.
Cool. And I'll mention once again at the tail of the show here that I am in New Digs. I've just been brought on as a contractor for ZipRecruiter.com. Unlike my previous couple gigs here in LA, though, these guys mostly work remote. So I'm only going to be in L.A. probably 1 to 2 weeks a month, but I can spend the rest of the time in Portland, driving my own car in Portland. That'll be really weird, sleeping in my own bed instead of wondering, you know, when are they going to do the sheets in my hotel bed and things like that, and running out of shampoo and all that sort of stuff. So it's going to be happy with that, and they're providing me a great place to work, and a lot of really sharp people I met. This is only my second day. It's the beginning of my second day. So,
well, it's a beautiful background you've got there.
Yeah,
the tree and everything.
I think the lighting's much better too.
Yeah,
so,
that's great. So you sound good.
Yeah, I just need to get them to put some diet sodas or some non-carby drinks in the fridge, and I'll be happy.
Yeah.
Everything here is healthy, which means it's full of carbs.
Right.
There's no added sugar. No added sugar.
Full of carbs
like
anyway.
Fruit juices and stuff. Oh,
absolutely. Oh. Hey, Randall, one more thing
sure.
I want to plug before I forget is we're starting up a makerspace in my hometown of Benicia, California. It's really for all of Solano County, and you can even go south from there into Martinez and Concord. If you live in California and you live in the Solano County area or in those communities I mentioned, you know, Concord, Martinez, those kind of things, and you're looking for a makerspace, let us know. Go to meetup.com and look for the Benicia Makerspace meetup and let us know if you're interested, because we're trying to get this thing kicked off the ground. I've been working on it for a few years with, you know, a few other folks. We're really trying to get this thing started, and I've been meaning to mention it every time I come on Floss, and I keep forgetting. I've been meaning to mention it for like 2 or 3 months now. So so please, if you're interested in a makerspace and you live in that area, go to meetup.com and look for our meetup group there and see if it's something that's of interest to you. We're having our first meeting coming up. I believe it's January 20th, somewhere in there. So we're going to be talking about Open Sprinkler, which is a open hardware sprinkler valve irrigation control system. So check it out.
Cool. Well, I think we're more than out of time. We're probably over my normal 1 hour
way
target,
over, yeah.
But that's what it takes. You know, I'm just so excited to be back with my Blue Yeti Pro and my Fez and the whole thing. I'm just so excited to be in a normal space again with bandwidth, actually with bandwidth. I love that. All right. So I think I'm going to wrap it up because we're out of time. We'll see you again next week on Floss Weekly.